We're looking at the book of Daniel. We were just wrapping up the 11th chapter last week. I had just read to you from 2 Maccabees 9, a little piece there about the ending of the life of Antiochus Epiphanes. And suddenly, the time was more than up. So, ended rather abruptly last time, but we've been looking at this chart. We won't deal with it much tonight, but just to orient us, this is Antiochus IV, Epiphanes of Syria right here. And we've been talking quite a bit about these kings. We were just wrapping it up, so we don't need the chart really, but I'll just put it there for a little while. Antiochus has been away from Israel, and now he finds out about the Maccabean revolt that's going on there and getting more and more effectual. And so he's coming back, trying to come back and make an end of the Jews, just completely eradicate them. He wants to do the same thing that Haman wanted to do to the Jews, but that no Babylonian or Persian conqueror has sought to do and or been successful in doing that. At Emmaus, the little city of Emmaus, made famous by Jesus' trip there later, Judas Maccabeus of the Maccabean family won so decidedly that the Syrian troops they fled clear out of the country. Lysias, whom Antiochus had put there as a helper to his young son Antiochus IV, came at Judas Maccabeus again, but was completely defeated. Judas regained possession of the entire country. He entered into the temple and removed all the signs of paganism that had been installed there, which we've talked about before. The altar dedicated to Jupiter or Zeus was taken down and a new altar erected to the God of Israel. The statue of Zeus that had the face of Antiochus probably was ground down into dust. We've talked about how Antiochus had it put there. Now it's ground down into dust. And then they had the 8-day feast of dedication known as Hanukkah every year since that time it's been celebrated. The Feast of Lights, the Festival of Lights. They celebrated this at the end of the 3-year period during which the temple had been desecrated. These are the 2300 evenings and mornings that we read about in the middle of the 8th chapter, and we talked about that quite extensively then. This was the culmination of those 2300 evenings and mornings. So the Maccabean struggle then went on for another 29 or 30 years. Peace came to the Holy Land when the Hasmonean dynasty began to rule. These are the Hasmoneans mentioned up here. And it got pretty much better during that time. This was a time of Jewish independent rule with no foreign monarch ruling over them. And for a few decades, they didn't know any foreign occupancy. But there was still a lot of chaos, still a lot of intrigue in the Promised Land, a lot of murder there. And, of course, Rome noticed this. Rome was a lover of order. And Rome is noticing this chaos. So they sent Pompey the Great over, and he occupied the land of Israel for the Romans in 63 B.C. And it was during the time of the Roman reign, of course, that the kingdom of God had been predicted to be established. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. Daniel 2:44. The coming Messiah was going to establish his kingdom. So Daniel has painted for us here a panorama of predicted history from the release of the Jews from Persia by the Edict of Cyrus, and then through lots of troublous times and to the end of the indignation and death of Antiochus Epiphanes, which we talked about in chapter 8, but I read to you about it last time in chapter 11 as well. This is all in preparation for the coming of the Messiah. And Daniel's message in all of this is that God will not desert his people in any of the storms of history. He will send his deliverance at the moment when their need has reached its highest point. And that is what happened. And we flow from this right into chapter 12, where he talks about Michael. Michael, back in chapter 10:21, remember, was called your prince. In other words, you're the prince of the people that Daniel represents, the Jews. Michael, your prince, shall stand up for his people. Were it not for the providential intervention of God, this persecution could have resulted in the annihilation of the Jews. That was Haman's goal in the book of Esther. It was Antiochus' goal here. both of them met their fate and the Jews were left alive. But although deliverance did come in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, or right after him, many people did perish. And I think Daniel's point is this, that God brought about his plan, and nobody can frustrate the redemptive purposes of God. Even those faithful who died in the persecution will still be victorious in the end. Because, as we're well aware, not all deliverances are of a fleshly temporal nature. The ultimate deliverance from death, the ultimate final victory over evil, is going to be the resurrection. And that's why I believe he goes into the resurrection here early in chapter 12, verse 2. This is the one redemptive event during which all of the faithful of all time will be raised in glory and all at the same time. So the resurrection is relevant to everybody. John 5, 28 and 29. The hour is coming in which all that are in the grave shall hear his voice and shall come forth, they that have done good unto the resurrection of righteousness, and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of condemnation. Just because life and immortality have been brought to light through the gospel, and we now have more insight through the New Testament than we did at the time of Daniel, that doesn't mean that the resurrection is going to mean any less to Abraham or to Daniel than it will to us. And the result of all this, we already saw back in chapter 4 from the pen of Nebuchadnezzar himself, that the Most High rules, that phrase is three times in chapter 4, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. God is working out a plan of redemption that goes beyond this life. When we see pictures of awful forest fires or houses, neighborhoods burning down, like in Southern California fairly recently, and you see all that inferno, we just need to remember that this whole place is going to burn. All this stuff around us is going to burn. God's deliverance of the Jews from annihilation preserved the nation through which the Savior was brought into the world. And one of these days, even though our bones lie in the dust of the earth, they shall be conformed to the body of the glorious Son of God, Philippians 3, 20 and 21. And we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. So that's how I think we link from chapter 11 to chapter 12 there about the resurrection. The resurrection is relevant to the people who were murdered at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and to all the rest of the saints of God who have been martyred by whatever method all through the years. Anybody got questions over chapter 11 before we go? Yeah, John, go ahead. Still want to call you Phil.
Well, I was thinking you mentioned how that the Assyrians let the people come back to Israel. And we know that Nebuchadnezzar and other Babylonian guys captured other nations.
Right.
Do we know if they let other nations go back the way that they did the Jews? I mean, this is just amazing.
The Jews seems to have been a special case there. We don't know precisely why this was allowed, but King Cyrus was the one who allowed it. But Jewish tradition tells us, and this is not historical, but Jewish tradition tells us that Daniel actually took a copy of the book of Isaiah, as the scroll of Isaiah, into King Cyrus and showed him where Cyrus was predicted 140 years before his birth, predicted by name. And the Lord called Cyrus 140 years before his birth, the Lord called Cyrus my shepherd and my anointed. Because there are two kinds of servants of God. There are voluntary servants of God like yourselves, and there are involuntary servants of God who do the will of God even though they don't mean to. And Cyrus saw that he was predicted to be a servant of God, and we're told that that impelled him to let the people go and return back. So they were a special case. Excellent question. Anybody else? Anything else? Okay, well, let's look at chapter 12, and we can always go back if you want to. I'll read 12:1. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people. Michael was always regarded as the angel, the archangel who looked especially after the people of God in the Old Testament. And there shall be a time of trouble such as was never since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. At that time, I think, is still looking at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Michael, your prince, as I said, he's called that in chapter 10, verse 21. He will stand up, he will interpose himself and render aid to the people of God. Michael always had the affairs of the people of God, especially under his protection, because he was regarded as the guardian angel of that nation. Predicted here in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, as we have already seen, is a time of trouble such as there never had been up to that time. You're well aware that in passages like Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, Jesus uses that same kind of language to speak of the trials that would later be brought unto the Jews by the Romans, and that came to pass in 70 AD. In each case, it was trouble greater than had ever occurred before in that nation's history. And when these troubles were at their height, thy people shall be delivered. That's the prediction. Verse 2, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Sleep is a description here in verse 2 of the appearance of the body of a dead person. It's called sleep, I believe, simply because of the similarity in appearance between a sleeping body and a dead body. How many times right here or in funeral homes have we seen the body of a brother or sister who has passed on laid out, and the undertaker has painted them up and they look asleep rather than actually being dead? So that's the reason that word is used, I think. Jesus said Lazarus is asleep when Lazarus really was dead. We're told by Paul, we shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed, obviously referring to dying. Those alive when the Lord returns shall not precede those who are asleep, we're told. The dead in Christ shall rise first, then which we are alive and remain shall be caught up. So the most common New Testament word representing death is sleep. But the soul or the spirit of a human being is never said to sleep in death. Here we're talking about the disposition of the body and the appearance of the body. So verse 2 is talking about the waking of human bodies, the resurrection of the body at the time of Christ's return. Sometimes people are disturbed by the use of the word many here in this verse. Many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, as if a considerable portion of them would be raised from the dead, but not all of them. But this is just a figure of speech. This particular figure of speech is known as synecdoche, and there are actually about 200 varieties of figures of speech found in the Bible. Many years ago, a man by the name of Bullinger wrote a great thick book about figures of speech used in the Bible. One time I typed up a couple of dozen of those figures of speech and included biblical examples of each of them, and you might have been here when I passed that out at some point years ago. The point is that all languages use figures of speech and idioms. We refer to these types of things all the time. If I say, back when I was knee-high to a grasshopper, that's an idiom. And since we're all speaking the same language, we all understand the same idioms. There's no grasshopper involved. It's just a figure of speech. If we say we had hot dogs for supper last night, it's a figure of speech. It's an idiom. You and I know what hot dogs are. We're not talking about warm canines, which would be a literal translation. It's not literal. It's a figure of speech. This does make translation more difficult, but it also makes language more colorful. So you give something up for everything you gain, I guess. Anyway, synecdoche is a figure of speech by which a part stands for the whole. And these kinds of figures of speech are used all the time. Not long ago, I was in a man's garage, and he had shelves that he had built into the wall of that garage, and there were boxes and all kinds of things in those shelves, just all the way from floor to ceiling. And he was talking about looking for something, and he said, "I looked high and low for that." Well, I didn't say to him, "Why didn't you look in the middle?" Because you and I know it's a figure of speech. High and low includes the middle, even though you didn't say anything about the middle. It's the same type of thing here. If about the beginning of the year or so, I heard somebody make the statement, Kansas City clinched a first-round bye and home field advantage throughout the playoffs. And what they meant was Kansas City's professional football team, the Chiefs, clinched. But you don't have to say all of that because everybody knows what you mean. Everybody understands it when you say Kansas City clinched. So we leave words out, we put extra things in, we turn things around, but as long as we're communicating, it works fine. And that's what's happening here. It's a synecdoche that's being used here. When Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, for example, he said in Matthew 26, 28, that his blood was shed for many for the remission of sins. Shed for many. Well, why wasn't it shed for everybody? Later on, the Apostle Paul makes clear that the Lord gave himself a ransom for all, 1 Timothy 2, verse 6. So many is used in the sense of a great many, meaning all. One more example here. In Romans 5, 12, we're told that death passed upon all as a consequence of Adam's sin. Physical death passed upon all. And then three verses later, in verse 15, he said that many died as a result of Adam's sin. So these expressions seem to be used rather interchangeably. And we know that the word many is used that way in Daniel 12 and 2 because Scripture elsewhere emphatically states that on the resurrection day, all that are in the graves shall come forth. And we already quoted John 5, 28 and 29. So the angel here, and with still the angel talking that started back in chapter 10, he declares that the resurrection is going to consist of two different classes or categories of people. Some will be raised to enjoy everlasting life, and some are destined for shame and everlasting contempt. There will be a single resurrection consisting of those two groups, not two resurrections separated by 1,000 years. It's difficult to miss the point of the term everlasting, I think, here. The Hebrew is the word olam. But this speaks of duration, the duration of the reward of the righteous and the torment of the wicked. Similar construction is seen in the New Testament where we have the Greek term aionios, the same translation of this expression is the same as that of olam in the Old Testament, speaking of the unending nature of the punishment of the lost, as well as the life of those who are the redeemed, Matthew 25, verse 46. And by the way, the word life does not connote mere existence, because even those who rebel against God are going to exist eternally, but life suggests the opposite of death. The wages of sin is death, Romans 6, 23. In a spiritual sense, this indicates a final and permanent separation from God and their shame and contempt to those who are destined for punishment. Shame suggests that which is the object of reproach. Contempt denotes that which is the object of aversion or abhorrence. So these terms, along with the modifier everlasting, reveal the abiding conscious torment of those who are being punished. This is not an existence that's going to fade into eventual nothingness, as some allege. Verse 3, and they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. The expression here, they that be wise, I think is just referring to those who serve God and keep his commandments. Each of the righteous is going to be like a bright and beautiful star. Those who tell the word to other people are going to resemble the heavenly constellations at night, thus to be distinguished and honored for all eternity. In verse 4, thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. So Daniel, these things aren't going to happen for a long time from your point of view, 600 years before Christ. Seal up the book. Now, this is just the opposite of the Apostle John when he received in one day the message that we call the book of Revelation at the end of the Bible as we have it arranged. To John writing the book of Revelation, he says the time is at hand. He says that at the beginning. He says it at the end of the book. The time is at hand for these things to begin to be fulfilled. I believe the fulfillment of the book of Revelation started the same year that it was written. But to Daniel, he doesn't say that. To Daniel, he says, seal the book till the time of the end, which would be some distant day. And he says, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased at that future time that he's talking about here. I think that we could say that our own age furnishes a good illustration of that type of an era, of the meaning of this kind of language here. As we go through this 12th chapter, I don't think we can avoid the impression that the full meaning of the language in this chapter is not met by the events that occurred at the time of the Maccabees. If nothing more than that was intended, I would feel that the events fell far short of this mysterious tone of language that's used from here on through the rest of this chapter. It looks to me like this passage is looking onward and to a higher and more important event than any that occurred in the times of Antiochus Epiphanes. So we'll examine that in the rest of this chapter. In verse 5, he says, "Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on this side of the bank of the river and the other on that side of the bank of the river." He's talking about the Tigris River, which was indicated back in chapter 10, also called the Hiddekel River, back in chapter 10, verse 4. But it's the same as the Tigris River. And then we come to verse 6. "One said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, 'How long shall it be to the end of these wonders?'" How long shall it be to the end of these wonders? As we come to the end of this amazing book, I think these wonders reference are perhaps all of the things that are predicted in the prophetic portions of the book of Daniel. Not only the little bit that we saw in chapter 2 with Nebuchadnezzar's image, but also what we've seen in chapter 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and chapter 12, because there's going to be a little more here in these last few verses. I think he's talking about all of that because the book is an absolute unit of things together. How long is it going to be to the end of these wonders that he's predicting? And we're told in verse 7, "I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven." Didn't just hold up his right hand to swear. He held up his right hand and his left hand, "and swear to him that liveth forever ever, that it shall be for a time, times, and a half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished." Well, the expression "time, times, and a half," in my mind, and probably yours, automatically takes us back to chapter 7, where we saw that same phrase earlier and talked about it quite a bit. Chapter 7, verse 25. There, we were talking about the great apostasy of the Lord's church and how it was going to hold virtual universal sway for a time, times, and a half. And then it would be the temporal power that it had would be taken away. And I told you back in chapter 7 when we talked about that, this was clear back in April, so you may or may not remember it, but this expression, "time, times, and a half," and its equivalents, is used 7 times in the Bible. It's used twice in the book of Daniel, 7:25 and 12:7, which we just read, and it's used 5 times in the book of Revelation. There are the 5 times in the book of Revelation. Notice they're not just anywhere in Revelation, but they're bunched up in that little bit that's called the little book that John ate, and it turns out to be a little book about the little horn that we read about in chapter 7. So this all goes together, and it's talking about the same thing. And to me, this reference to time, times, and a half is a significant key here. I told you when we looked at chapter 7 that I believe that this expression, wherever it occurs in Daniel or the book of Revelation, and whether it's called 1260 days, 42 months, time, times, and half a time, I believe it always refers not only to the same amount of time, but to the same period of time, the same set of years of time. I'm very sure about that, the other 6 times that it's used, so I see no reason to make an exception here, even though the language here is admittedly more obscure. But I do apply the day-year principle here, as I do elsewhere in the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation, and I apply it, as I told you when we looked at chapter 7, based on Numbers 14:34, Ezekiel 4:6. Numbers 14:34, just by way of review there, this was when the children of Israel sent 12 spies into the promised land for a period of 40 days, and they came back and said, "We can't take the land." So God said, "Okay, you had 40 days to check it out and develop confidence in me, but you don't have faith in me, so you're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years now. Each day that you were in the land and should have developed faith, you have to wander a year for each day. Each day for a year. And Ezekiel 4:6, Ezekiel had to lay on one side for a certain period of time, on the other side for a certain period of time, and each day represented a year in a prophecy that he was making. So this is a biblically oriented idea, a day for a year. And also, as we saw in the ninth chapter, just by way of review, the 70 weeks in chapter 9 must be, of course, literally 70 weeks would be 490 days, but they must represent 490 years there, because 490 literal days is less than 2 years and could not possibly have fulfilled the prophecy that we see in Daniel chapter 9 about the 490 years. So I see this, it's called the day-year theory, but I think it's more than a theory. I see it as proven as true in chapter 9 alone and elsewhere also. So I'm to the place that I need to tell you, I believe, a very significant thing. Some have called Antiochus Epiphanes the Mosaic Age Antichrist. And I think there's something to this. He was a contemptible persecutor of God's people. In chapter 7, we saw predicted a Christian Age Antichrist, one who was opposed to God. And this Antichrist was to emerge from within the church itself. Just by way of review again, so we have this under our belts and we're all on the same page. You don't have to agree with it, but I just want you to see what I'm saying. Think of what chapter 7 said about this individual, or this dynasty of kings, as we decided that they were. This Antichrist or pseudo-Christ is going to have a look more stout than his fellows. He's going to make war with the saints and prevail against them. He will speak great words against the Most High. He will wear out the saints of the Most High. He would think to change times and laws. And we spent considerable time showing how a historical entity did all of these things, fulfilling them to a T. And this was going to go on until a time, times, and dividing of time. This same period of time. Same period of time that we see here in chapter 12, and I believe it refers to the same period of time here in chapter 12 as it does in chapter 7. I said all that to just try to make that point. Back when we were talking about chapter 7, we started this in the year 533 AD when Justinian, the Eastern Emperor, declared the Pope to be, for the first time, the head of all the churches. The Pope was declared to be the universal Father. It had taken him a long time to accumulate that kind of power, but he finally was looked on in that way. And then we took that 1260 years and added it to 533 and came up with 1793, which was the time of the French Revolution. And I gave you quite a lot of detail about the French Revolution and how it broke, like nothing else did, it broke the back of the papal dynasty. So that's all review from chapter 7, but now we're here and it's talking about that same period of time in chapter 12, and it's going to extrapolate on that a little more. So I need to tell you that there is the principle of gradualness in these great historical sweeping events over time. Gradualness is a significant issue here. Just as the Babylonian captivity occurred not just once, but in three main phases. It's important to recognize this. The Babylonian captivity didn't just occur all at once. First of all, Daniel and his friends were taken away. Then Ezekiel and his peers were taken away in another captivity years later. And finally, 586 BC, the destruction of the temple and the city of Jerusalem. So the Babylonian captivity occurs in three different phases, and I think you're well familiar with that. Also, when they came back, there were three different returns from the Babylonian captivity that was allowed by the Medo-Persian Empire. There was that of Zerubbabel, who was allowed back first to rebuild the temple after the events that John and I were just talking about, when Isaiah purportedly went in and showed him in Isaiah chapters 44 and 45 where he was predicted by name. And then we also have the return of Ezra to restore the law, and finally that of Nehemiah to rebuild the wall and the city. So we have this graduality principle here back in the Old Testament. We also saw that the development of the great apostasy was gradual as well. It took centuries for it to occur. as predicted by both Daniel and the Apostle Paul, as well as the Apostle John. It was a very gradual thing. Martin Luther called it the Babylonian captivity of the church, because there is such a correspondence there. It took a long time for this to develop, if only because no one generation of people would have stood for that much change during their single lifetime. And on this, I cited Brother Brumback's church history, and I think I may have given you a chart to show the gradualness of these changes. It took centuries for the Bishop of Rome to accumulate the power to hold universal sway and be recognized as the Pope or Papa of the Roman Church, the Vicar of Christ. We saw how he progressively became King of the Papal States after the time that Justinian declared him to be the Universal Father. He became a king as well as being a pope, with a lot of temporal power in addition to his presumed spiritual power. And just as the ascent to his apogee was gradual, so the dissolution of the papal power was gradual. And that's what I think is being depicted here in chapter 12. Though it is obscure, and I could be wrong, it's only fair to tell you that I'm not as sure about what I'm about to tell you as I have been about most of the rest of what I've told you over these past 11 sessions that we've had together on these Wednesday nights. Almost everything I say to you, I stole from somebody else because it commends itself to me, it looks right to me, and I have the guy that originally thought it as one witness, and I can be the second witness, so it's established in the mouth of two witnesses at least. Almost everything I say to you, I steal. I try to only steal from the best, but I do steal it. We're born awfully late to be original about anything, and especially when we're talking in terms of religion. It's almost impossible to be original without being wrong. So that's one reason I have some trepidation about what I'm going to tell you, is because I've never heard it anywhere else from anybody else, and don't think I haven't tried. When I was young, I talked to every evangelist of my father's generation about these next few verses. I called everybody I could think of that I thought might know, and I just didn't find anybody that could tell me. I read every commentary that I could get my hands on about it. And let me tell you can read yourself cross-eyed just on this one chapter and be more confused than you were when you started. You can actually overthink yourself into brain freeze just on these few verses. Multiple times I went on my knees to our Heavenly Father about this chapter when I was young, and I eventually decided that I just don't understand it any better than Daniel did. So I'm not saying that what I'm going to tell you is right. I'm only going to say that it's the best that I can do, and I sincerely hope that you can do better, and if you can do better, I will thank you profusely for that. But I'm going to tell you what I think it means. Let's look at Okay, I think I read 7. I'll read 8. I heard, but I understood not, and then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? Verse 9, he said, go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed to the time of the end. So, Daniel, this is not for you to see during your earthly lifetime. You don't have to actually know what it means because it doesn't pertain to you. You don't even need to worry about it, Daniel. No amount of fretting about this is going to help you figure it out. The words are closed up. They are sealed unto the time of the end. When these things happen, the events themselves will unfold the meaning of the prediction more fully, and they will confirm the truth by their correspondence to it. So now let me read what he's actually talking about here. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. That's pretty self-explanatory. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Now, Jesus, of course, quotes in the book of Matthew about this abomination of desolation. We've seen that in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, that what they did to the temple area was regarded, setting up that statue of Zeus and all, in this holy precinct was regarded as the abomination of desolation when they smeared the hog flesh, which was an anathema to the Jews, all over the altar of God. That was all the abomination of desolation. Jesus uses this expression later to refer predictively to the Romans. If we take the time that the daily shall be taken away and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, in other words, if we take the things that Antiochus Epiphanes did literally, and we take these symbolically to refer to the dominance of the papal dynasty, then it's possible to view Antiochus Epiphanes as a type of the papal dynasty. And I think that's what he's telling us here. Just as Antiochus setting up the image of Zeus that likely had his own face in the temple compound, in a similar way, the man of sin predicted in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the son of perdition who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. The end of the 1290 days must be marked by some event. And if the 1290 days is just 30 years beyond the 1260 days, which seems to be the most natural understanding, let's see what happened then. 1290 days would be representative of 1290 years. 1793, which ends the 1260, adding 30 years to that to come to 1290 would bring us to 1823 A.D. I think that the thing that did happen in this year is significant. The election of Pope Leo XII in that year. His predecessor, Pope Pius VII, remember when we talked about the French Revolution, we went a little bit beyond the revolution to some other predictions regarding Napoleon. The predecessor of Leo XII was Pius VII, and he was the one who was insulted by Napoleon when Napoleon made himself emperor in 1804. Remember, he made this old sick pope make a journey of 1,000 miles to Paris rather than going to Rome to be exalted as a Holy Roman Emperor, which every other Holy Roman Emperor had done to be crowned by the Pope. He made the Pope come to Paris in a time when travel was not very easy. And then instead of letting the Pope crown him, he took the crown away from the Pope, turned his back on the Pope, and held the crown above his own head, and Napoleon crowned himself in the sight of all Paris in Notre Dame Cathedral in 1804. That's the Pope that we're talking about then. So in the course of 10 years, Napoleon deposed two popes and drove them out of Rome. Pius VII was actually arrested by Napoleon and interned in virtual isolation. Pius VII returned to Rome, but had to flee again when Napoleon escaped from Elba. Remember, they put him down on a little island in the Mediterranean, but he escaped and went back and took over France again for another 100 days or so. Next time they caught him, they put him out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean on the island of St. Helena, where he couldn't get away. And he died there, probably of stomach cancer, I think. Anyway, the Church of Rome was in disarray everywhere at this time. They made an attempt to adapt the papacy to the modern world. And that's where Leo XII comes in here. There's a striking change here. He's elected in this very year, 1823, elected by the Zelante, who were the conservatives, who wanted to focus on the religious rather than the political orientation of the papacy. All through the years, the popes have been kings, and they have held sway in a very temporal way, yielding power over the kings of the earth, using the armies of the nations of Europe as their own. And this had gone on and on through one pontificate after another. So now they're making a decided change toward the religious rather than the political orientation of the papacy. There were fears in the European courts that Pius VII's conciliatory policies were going to be reversed. And that's why he was hated. Pope Leo XII was a hated and unpopular pope all the way up till his death in 1829. But he suggested that the papacy as the spiritual leader of humanity should cease to rely on political action, and that's what we're getting to. A change in the papacy that's becoming more like the papacy is in our own time. Very different from what they had been used to in the past. Not political action anymore, but just the spirituality of it. The guiding theme of his pontificate was not politics, but religious renewal. Unceasing warfare against errors which threatened the faith as he saw it, was dominant during his time. But collaboration with the conservative sovereigns of his time. His predecessors had already affirmed the neutrality of the Holy See toward political changes in the South American republics, for example. The popes originally wanted to have a lot to do with what went on over here in the New World. I told you they drew the dividing line in South America. They got off, infallibility or not, they got off, and that's why the Portuguese only got Brazil, because Brazil stuck out into the Atlantic, and that's the only part of South America that they got. And that's why in Brazil today, Portuguese is the national language, but the rest of South America is Spanish, because Spain got everything except Portugal, because the Pope drew the line in the wrong place. But they were very involved here, but the South American republics didn't particularly want that. The Pope's involvement in the New World started out very strong, but that was going to change. And we come to the 1335 years in verse 12. Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,305 at 5 and 30 days. This is just 45 years more added on from 1823 till plus 45 brings us to 1868 A.D. By this time, we have come through Garibaldi. Remember, he was an Italian hero. He was actually called the hero of two worlds because he not only was a part of the revolutions in Italy in 1848 and 1860, but he also came over here to Uruguay and other South American countries and fought in revolutions here. He was a very charismatic individual, looked quite a bit like Fidel Castro, actually, who was also the Cuban leader who was very charismatic. So you can think of him in that kind of a way. But if there's one thing about Garibaldi to remember, it's that he absolutely detested priests. He thought they were a scourge on the Italian nation, and he called the papacy a cancer. He was known as the hero of two worlds, as I said, the two worlds being the old world and the new, basically in South America. He had a lot to do with these revolutions in 1848 and 1860. We come here in 1868. We're in the pontificate of Pope Pius IX, who's the most important pope in modern history. His pontificate was from 1846 to 1878. He had a longer pontificate than any pope has ever had. Pope John Paul II came close, or Pope John Paul I came, or no, he was the second. He came close, but he didn't quite make this record. This was a deeply religious pope, but he was politically inept. It turns out he was the last pope king. In other words, the last pope who was also a king. And by 1868, he had seen his dominions, with the exception of Rome and its immediate environs, annexed to the new kingdom of Italy. Italy had always been a boot sticking out in the Mediterranean Sea, but it had never been a nation. There had been a number of nations, little pieces of land in there that had been their own little nation states. The Italian peninsula had never been a nation yet, but now it's in the process of becoming a nation, and what used to belong to the Pope is now coming to belong to the kingdom, the new kingdom of Italy. The popes, as we may have seen, first became kings in the Middle Ages, and for more than 1,000 years, the popes had ruled over the papal states. I told you how they kept them medieval and primitive when the railroads were first developed. If you were a farmer in southern Italy, you could put your crops on a train to get a better price up north. But when you got to the papal states, you had to take your crop off of the train because there were no railroads allowed in the papal states. Put it on ox carts, take it across the papal states before you can put it on a railroad again. People are only going to put up with that for so long, and then they're going to rebel. And that's exactly what happened. But the more the Pope became restricted temporarily, the more bizarre his pronouncements became. For instance, in 1854, by 1868, he's seen all his dominions, with the exception of Rome and its immediate environs, annexed to the new kingdom of Italy. 1854, he declared, all of a sudden, the Immaculate Conception of Mary. This had never been declared before, but if you're going to have the principle of original sin, which is not a biblical idea, but if you're going to believe in original sin, then somehow you've got to get Jesus into the world unpolluted, and you can't do that if his mother is polluted. So that's why he declares the Immaculate Conception of Mary, which is not the same thing as the virgin birth. This means that Mary herself was born without the taint of original sin. And he just flatly declared that that was the case. But the main thing I wanted to tell you about here is that in 1868, the very year we're looking at, the end of the 1335 days, the First Vatican Council was called. And it was called for the purpose of decreeing the infallibility of the Pope. This idea had been bandied about for years, but now we have a council called to decree it, which they did. This completed the doctrinal development of centuries. Pope Pius IX wanted to be infallible all the time, but he had to settle for being infallible when speaking ex cathedra in matters of faith and morals. He got this decree made. It actually came through in 1870, but it was by this First Vatican Council, and what triggered the action occurred in 1868, the end of the 1335 years. The French had said that they would leave Rome if this were decreed, because they didn't want to believe the Pope was infallible. So when this was declared, they did leave Rome, and that's what allowed Rome, the city of Rome itself, to be taken by the Italians. And there was an outbreak of anti-clericism in Europe generally. This 1868 call is what triggered the action that ended the Pope's temporal power. Yes, it was broken first by the French Revolution, but now this really ends the temporal power of the Pope, even in Italy. On September the 20th, 1870, Italian forces occupied Rome itself, and in October of that year, Rome was incorporated by a plebiscite into the Italian state. So he lost his own city, and he's back down to the little 110 acres of Vatican City, where he still is today. And from that time forward, Pope Pius IX never set foot outside of the Vatican again. And he called himself the prisoner of the Vatican. He made a big deal about this. In fact, for the next 59 years, after the taking of Rome by the Italians, no pope would set foot outside of the Vatican for 59 years. No pope would enter into any church building in Rome, because that was foreign territory now. No pope would escape the summer heat by retreating to the papal villa in the nearby hills, because to travel beyond this little patch of land called Vatican City would mean acknowledging that the Pope was no longer the prisoner of the Vatican, and that for almost six full decades the popes were unwilling to do. David Kirchner wrote a book called Prisoner of the Vatican that tells that whole story in considerable detail, and I think some of you might enjoy that book. Pope Pius IX, as I said, was longer for Pope longer than any other man has ever been Pope. And when he died, he had effectively created the modern papacy, stripped completely of its temporal dominion. He left the Catholic Church profoundly changed and ill-equipped to deal with its challenges. The government had banned all church processions in Rome, which no longer belonged to the church, believing them to be a dangerous provocation to the patriotic Italians. So during his funeral procession, during this Pope's funeral procession in 1881, a mob pelted this funeral procession of the Pope with rocks and threatened, and almost did, throw the Pope's corpse into the Tiber River as they were going over the bridge. Sometimes it's said that modern Italy was founded over the dead body of Pope Pius IX. That's how significant this particular pontificate was. The greatest foe to the creation of modern-day Italy was the Pope. And I'll just say one more thing here, because I've gone a little past the time, not as bad as I did last week, but I'm a little past the time here. Just let me say one more thing here, just to bring it home to us, because I'm saying what happened at the end of the 1335 days in 1868 is what triggered all of this. And now we come down to our own time. On January the 6th, 2025, Pope Francis, who was still alive at the time, as you'll recall, he appointed Cardinal McElroy, Bishop of San Diego, to lead the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. And the reason he did that, he had one reason for doing that. We had a new president that was going to be inaugurated just 2 weeks later on January the 20th, and he made this change in order to fight President Trump. But you didn't know about that probably, and I only know about it by happenstance, because it doesn't matter. Nobody cares. And the reason nobody cares is because the Pope is a relative non-entity now. This is the kind of papacy that you have and I have seen through our entire lifetime, and it's what we expect from the papacy, but much different than it used to be. Well, it's time for us to stop, so we're ready for announcements.